Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Today we have as our guest someone who needs no introduction to most people who live in the Champaign-Urbana area. Danielle Chenoweth is a co-founder and currently a board member of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. From 2001 to 2008, she served as a city council member in Chicago and also as mayor in Urbana, and also as mayor pro tem in Urbana. And she's been on the Telecommunications and Public Access TV commissions, and she's instigated all sorts of important work on public wireless, broadband, and arts programs. She's had a storied career as a public servant at a fairly young age. Danielle Chenoweth, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Now, Danielle, just for a second, I know many of our listeners are familiar with you. I know a little bit about your story. What got you to Champaign-Urbana, and how did you get involved in becoming a city council member in Urbana at a fairly young age?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Actually, I've pretty much always been interested in art and politics. And so after I graduated from New College, which is in Sarasota, Florida, I was kind of surveying the field and thinking, where do I want to land? And, Berkeley was an option. Atlanta was an option. I was interested in Champaign-Urbana actually because of the arts community and the political atmosphere here. There's a long tradition of organizing in this community, and I was interested in doing political performance theater. So I actually came here as a touring performer.
What year was that?
That was 1995.
And then the rest is history.
So to speak. Actually, what seems to happen to me, and when I was in college, this happened, and it continues to happen. I was sitting on the lawn kind of studying, and someone came up to me and said, "Hey, I'm looking for Danielle Chenoweth." And I said, "Well, you happen to have found the right person." And this teenager said, "Hey, I heard that you could help us save our school." And I was like, "Really? What? Me?" It looked at that the Board of Education in Sarasota was going to close this magnet school for both gifted and dropout prevention kind of youth. And they wanted me to help them organize to keep their school going. Same thing happened when I moved to Champaign-Urbana. I was a school bus driver at the time and trying to make some money as a performer. And a coworker of mine came to me and said, "I'm facing homelessness." And I was like, "That's terrible." And she said, "The city is joint marketing my property and the trailer park I live to make student luxury apartments." And I said, "Okay, well, let's go talk to your neighbors." So I went and talked to the neighbors, and we actually organized Friends of Lincoln Mobile Home Park, and we got relocation for 150 of the poorest residents in Champaign-Urbana. So these things kind of come my way, and as a result, I found myself being asked to run for public office. So I became a city council member for two terms because I'm interested in organizing for justice, and I thought that local democracy was a great place to start with that.
Two terms on the Urbana City Council. What was that like? Did you think it was a place where you could get good stuff done?
Yeah, actually, I have an office in the basement of my house, and I wrote up on the whiteboard there 12 things I wanted to do. And each time I accomplished one of them, I would check it off. And so by the end of the two terms, I had actually checked everything off. I found Urbana to be a fantastic place to get things done, and I actually think that's where we can get things done. I don't think we have democracy on the federal level, but I do think that there's hope for democracy on the local level.
Our guest today in Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Danielle Chenoweth, who's joining us for the full hour. We taped this show a few weeks before going on air because I'm going to be out of the country at the time this airs on July 1st. And Danielle was generous enough to come into the studio at WILL to talk with me. There's a lot to talk about. You've got a sense already of some of the ground Danielle's covered in her career. But a big part of her career, why we're having her on the air, is she's been one of the big media activists, not only in the community, but really nationally over the last 10 or 15 years. And one thing I want to talk about right off the top is the upcoming grassroots radio conference, Danielle, that you're one of the organizers of, that will be taking place in Champaign-Urbana at the end of July. What is the grassroots radio conference? How many of them have there been? Why is it in Champaign-Urbana? And what's happening?
So the grassroots radio conference, the very first one was in 1996 in reaction to increasing commercialization both of public radio and also a lack of support within community radio for volunteer-based stations. And so if for those listening who are media policy buffs, what happened in 1996? Well, that happened to be the big Telecommunications Act, where there was massive media consolidation. And I think that that was a piece of the story. So the first, the Grassroots Radio Conference is basically folks who are interested in volunteer-driven community radio. They get together each year at a different station across the country. And this year, it's coming to Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, which is the home of WRFU. WRFU 104.5 FM is our local low-power community radio station here in Urbana. And so this year's conference, you know, I guess having worked in community radio since the early 90s, I feel like community radio is at this crossroads. It both has these kind of major challenges it's facing in light of the recession, the fact that, you know, just because of the history of kind of institutionalization within radio, that the radio stations of the 60s and 70s that were really counterculture have kind of become entrenched somewhat in their communities. And so we see a kind of, and of course, there's a lot of folks who are going on the internet to consume their audio content. And so we have these kind of threats, so to speak, to community radio. At the same time, we have this fantastic opportunity where in the next 12 months, the Federal Communications Commission is going to open up a window that's going to allow for thousands of new community radio stations. And this will be the biggest expansion of community radio in U.S. history. So at the same time we have these challenges, we have this fantastic opportunity to bring all these voices on air in their local communities. So, go ahead.
Well, just for sake of clarification and definitions, there's low-power FM stations like WRFU, and then there's like community stations, as I understand it, like WEFT in Champaign, and then there's NPR-type stations like WIL, all of which are nonprofit and semi-non-commercial. Now, so this is a movement of both the low power stations and also the established community stations like WEFT or WRT in Madison or the Pacifica stations in New York and the Bay Area?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, they're different eras. So there was a whole bunch of community stations. We call them full power stations. Mm-hmm. They can reach many miles, like WEFT here in Champaign mm-hmm. reaches most of East Central Illinois. And those stations came on air with the opening of licenses in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of black college radio stations and native stations that got on in the 80s. And so after that, there was really a closing of the spectrum. In fact, in the 1990s, there was actually, or it's 1980, actually, when the Federal Communications Commission chose to cut off low power stations. So they took back those licenses and they shut down that piece. And so what we saw is this consolidation and this closing of airwaves, this closing of the spectrum. And so many of us activists in the field have been working for decades to really open that back up and to make more space for these kind of non-commercial community voices. So there was a wave at the end of the 90s. There was actually a kind of burgeoning pirate movement. And in response in part to that and media consolidation, the FCC created the Low Power FM service. That service reaches about 3 to 7 miles. It's a 100-watt station. And just to give you a sense of it, a low power station costs $10,000 to get on the air. A full power station could cost $250,000 to get on the air. So these are really different kind of sizes of stations. Unfortunately, when the low power service was created, the corporate broadcasters kind of swooped in like vultures and decided to shut down that service. And they forced Congress to pass the Broadcast Preservation Act, which basically limited LPFMs to rural areas. So 800 stations approximately went on the air, and about half of those were community, and about half were evangelical kind of right-wing networks at that time. So we've been fighting for the last 10 years to kind of get that spectrum back and to have full implementation of low-power FM. And, of course, we passed the Local Community Radio Act more recently. So it's going to be the Grassroots Radio Conference is really an opportunity for the kind of old-school radio stations to play a mentorship role with these new groups that are trying to get on air in the next few years. And so that convergence of generations is will hopefully create a real dynamic presence at the conference.
Our guest, Danielle Chenoweth, you've just been listening to. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in today. Just relax, enjoy the show. Let Danielle and myself do the yakking. Danielle Chenoweth is a co-founder and current board member of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. She's also an organizing volunteer for the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, and she's also currently the director of planning for the Prometheus Radio Project. Those of you unfamiliar with the Prometheus Radio Project, it has been the driving force for over a decade now in the campaign to establish low-power FM stations across the country that culminated in the passage of the Local Community Radio Act that Danielle just spoke about. And it's responsible, is one of the key groups responsible for the establishment of a group like WRFU here in Urbana. And so what goes on at a thing like the Grassroots Radio Conference? If someone in the audience wanted to attend it, what would they find?
Well, so it's for media activists, engineers, organizers, and ordinary citizens to come together and to strategize about the future of community radio, as well as to get your hands dirty and do some kind of hands-on work. And so folks who will come will learn basically the basics of both starting and running a community radio station start to finish. So you'll learn how to solder headphones when they break, which they happen to always break. You'll learn how to build a transmitter. You'll learn how to produce radio. You'll also learn how to resolve conflict within your station because these are community curated spaces. And you'll learn how to kind of reach out with wide arms and kind of bring a lot of diverse constituents into a single radio station so that these radio stations really reflect and respond to the needs of their communities.
Do you have any speakers coming in of note for the conference?
Yes, Joe Torres from Free Press. He's author of News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media, has graciously offered to be our keynote speaker, and he'll be speaking on Friday night. And so for those who are interested, you can come to the whole conference, or you can also just buy a ticket to come hear Joe Torres speak on Friday night. And the ticket cost, 100% of that will actually go to a scholarship fund to help those news stations that are trying to get online, as well as local area youth, access the Grassroots Radio Conference.
Now, for people locally who could listen to WRFU or WEFT, in addition, clearly they're listening to WILL right now, you know, what are the differences between a WRFU and a WEFT? I mean, do they have different feels to them, or are they basically pretty similar except they have different signals?
Well, there's a kind of evolution of community radio that's happened over time, and a group like the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which really represents a lot of the full power stations, had been pushing for more kind of strip programming and kind of set schedules. And oftentimes, in an attempt to help these stations survive, really push for more like jazz and blues and world music during the day and kind of more standardized public affairs programming. And so although you'll hear eclectic programming on WEFT, and I'm a longtime WEFTie and I was a board member for a while, it is the case that a lot of the eclectic programs, I used to run a show called Eclectic Seizure, I guess it's as eclectic as you get, used to happen at midnight or 10 o'clock in the evening. So I think the difference between these kind of traditional community radio stations is they tend to have more strip format programming. Places like RFU and the new low power stations, they tend to not have any paid staff. It's all volunteer driven. It's very small, curated by volunteers. And it tends to have a lot of eclectic program. It's a real mix up and churn up. And there's something really kind of vital and exciting. I feel like low power is kind of on the edges of things so that, you know, it's easy entry. It's very inexpensive. People can try things out and experiment. And what we see, as we see with everything on the edges, is those are like very fertile places for new talent and new ideas to kind of churn. And sure, there's a lot of mess ups and there's a lot of bad content, but there's also really interesting things that happen there. And with those low power stations, those kind of edges, people get discovered. Emerging artists get heard. People can begin to kind of build their lives and their community connections. And so I feel like low power really has a role to play just because of the bar. But I also think that actually community radio is changing. And one of the things we're going to talk about at the Grassroots Radio Conference is the future of community radio and really trying to set a vision for where all these community radio stations could go. The WEFs, the full power, kind of traditional 60s and coming out of the 60s and 70s stations, and the newer stations of the kind of 21st century, these low power stations, as well as a handful of full power stations, which were licensed in 2007, what these can do. And I think what is really at the root of that vision is really strong participatory media centers, multimedia centers. And so instead of it, you know, I think that the era of the kind of shock jocks or the singleton person sitting on the air playing their favorite records, you know, that was exciting for a period of time when we didn't have the internet. And I really don't think that that is the future of community radio. I think the future of community radio is real collective curation, voices that you just can't hear anywhere. So, for example, I don't know if people know in Champaign-Urbana that we have this Vietnamese population of refugees that came here after the Vietnam War. We also have this specialty population of folks from Appalachia. Those two constituencies, you're not going to hear on the air, even on WILL or on WEFT. But we, these low-power stations, really need to reach out and kind of wrap their hands around the whole community and these voices that we just never hear and these perspectives we never hear. These are the kind of voices and perspectives that we need to bring into the radio.
Danielle Chenoweth, how do these stations, and there are hundreds now and there may well be thousands coming, these low-power FM stations, which are by license non-profit and I assume non-commercial.
Correct.
How are they, even if you're volunteer, you still got heating bills, lighting bills, electric bills. You still got, you know, stuff you have to do to stay open as an operation. Where are the funds going to come from?
Well, so a couple of things. Let me talk about how much funds, and then I can talk about where they can come from. So a low power station can cost about $10,000 to launch, and it can really, because it doesn't have staff and very little overhead, can be a few hundred dollars a month to run. The biggest fee, honestly, is licensing fees, which are several hundred dollars for a couple of different licensing categories. And so they really can operate on shoestring budgets. We at Prometheus are doing outreach along with about 200 organizational partners across the country. And we're talking to LGBTQ centers and saying, hey, do you have a room in your center where you could convert that into a studio? And that could actually be a broadcast center for you to reach out to the community. So the costs are, I think, very manageable. I think the biggest cost is really that upfront cost. One of the things, a lot of community radio stations of this size really reach out to their local place-based foundations and community foundations to match the grassroots fundraising that they do to get on air. So you can imagine a community foundation maybe giving $5,000 to $7,000 and being able to raise $5,000 to $7,000 from your community, match that, you're able to build your station. And so I think that it's less money is the issue, and it's much more kind of making sure that there's community glue and community collaboration, real solid governance to make sure that these stations are able to survive into the future.
Does the fact that it's volunteer labor, completely volunteer driven, does that sometimes make it then much more difficult for people who don't, you know, who have to work and don't have a lot of free time to be involved?
I certainly think that that's a component. Because of newer technologies, people are able to pre-produce and then air those shows so they can basically go where they need to. And also with internet technology, you know, we're at RFU, we turn the community into a mobile broadcast studio, and we basically use cell phone and laptop to broadcast back. So we're able to get voices on the air of folks who maybe were working population who aren't able to connect. But if you look at, for example, the majority of folks who are on the air are low-income people. And a lot of folks who come to us are folks who really feel shut out and marginalized. And they, you know, maybe because of their religious preference or their sexual orientation, you see a lot of folks who are able to come. And it's really a creative endeavor for them to be able to produce a show and have access to an audience like this. They don't really have that in other contexts.
What would happen is anyone who wants to do a show can get one. But what happens if you run out of spaces?
Well, so it's usually the case that there's a programming committee of volunteers who take proposals from the community for shows. And so that programming committee may find that something's outside of the mission. Maybe it's commercial, or maybe there's too much of that on the air, or it's just a lot of corporate music. So I don't know if everyone gets on the air, but there's some curation process, which, by the way, I don't really feel like the internet has in the same way. So I feel like that's a value of community radio. What we see, because there's 24/7 programming, is that typically either you don't run out of air, like most of the stations have automation on for periods of time, and the competition is really for those drive times or those daytime hours. One of the things I think community radio really needs to grapple with is that people got on the air, but there was never an end date. So there are folks who got shows who literally been on the air for decades, and there's no way to really renew their show. And so one of the things that we've been proposing is really, you know, there should be a process by which new folks and new voices can come on the air. And, you know, folks who have been on the air for a while, maybe it's time for them to step aside and allow some of these new voices to get on air.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Danielle Chenoweth, who you've just been listening to. Danielle Chenoweth, former city council member in Urbana, one of the co-founders of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, and one of the organizers now of the upcoming Grassroots Radio Conference. And Danielle, again, if people want to look that up, what's the URL?
It's grassrootsradioconference.org.
GrassrootsRadioConference.org, which is upcoming in a few weeks in late July here in Champaign-Urbana. And so go look that up and attend it. I've attended one in the past. It's really a great experience. Danielle, you also work for the Prometheus Radio Project. I talked about it briefly before. I'll just say a few words about what the Prometheus Radio Project does for listeners who might not be aware of it.
So the Prometheus Radio Project is a nonprofit out of Philadelphia that helps to advocate for the expansion of community radio and community media. And we specifically helped to pass the Local Community Radio Act that opens up the spectrum for thousands of new stations. We also help groups apply for those licenses, start and launch their stations, and we do help them sustain those stations over time. So our vision is really kind of to have the entire nation kind of dotted with a community radio station in every town. And what we say is a town without a community radio station is kind of like a town without a library. It's really missing an important and vital piece of the media ecosystem. And so our goal is to really kind of help fill in that piece for all the communities across the country.
And this Community Radio Act that was passed, the Local Community Radio Act, I mean, that's an extraordinary accomplishment. How on earth did that ever get passed in this political environment where the commercial broadcasting industry, you know, has so much leverage in Congress?
Well, the answer, Bob, is hula hoops. That's how we passed it. We advocated for 10 years. We worked on a bipartisan bill to expand the spectrum. And I say hula hoops because in the final hours, this was end of 2011, I was actually the campaign coordinator at that time. And it really looked like we were not going to pass the bill. And we were told that if 2011 closed and we didn't pass the bill and Congress ended, we didn't have the same supporters going into the next season. We thought it was dead forever. So 10 years of work, all this investment, where it doesn't look like it's going to pass. Nothing is moving through Congress. I'm 7 months pregnant, sitting in my easy chair here in Urbana, trying to figure out how are we going to do this. And, you know, knocking on every kind of, looking for every point of leverage we possibly can. One of the things that we did, actually, the National Association of Broadcasters was the biggest barrier, and they really had a lot of Congress people in their pockets. And, you know, we had to kind of whack the mole where every time we would pull off a hold on the bill, you know, somebody else would slap a hold down. And it was just crazy. So we decided that we needed to go to the extreme. And we had clowns and circus performers and radio activists show up on the front porch of the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, with hula hoops. We also juggled radios, and we did have unicycles. And we basically put on a circus, and we said, you know, we called the president of the NAB to come down and talk with us and say, you know, why are you holding up this bill and progress? And we got some really nice press, especially some good Hill press from that. There was a lot of kind of embarrassment, and the NAB pulled their influence, and we were able to get the bill to sail through. We had to make a few tweaks that's going to make the implementation a little bit harder, but we feel like we're able to successfully get it through.
Danielle Chenoweth with our guest. You've just been listening to. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. Please don't call in. Let us do the talking. Danielle, something you've been involved with as long as I've known you that's become sort of a centerpiece of the Champaign-Urbana area is the Independent Media Center. And it's, you know, talk a little bit, if you would, about the principles of an independent media center and how it's evolved in Urbana over the years.
Well, so, you know, as you know, because you're a historian, independent media was not born yesterday. It's really been a rich tradition of U.S. democracy, kind of going back to the broadsides and, you know, the post office's support of magazines and you know, there are different generations of what independent media looks like. One of the more recent generations of independent media is really came out of the Zapatista movement when, using the internet, Zapatistas were able to really get an international audience for the kind of human rights work that they were doing in Chiapas, Mexico. And that really influenced folks in the United States and across the world to kind of claim the internet as an open publishing space. So this is a pre-blog era, a time when people were not able to publish on the web. I was actually a web consultant, and I was paid top dollar to help people access the web because ordinary folks couldn't do that. And we, indie media tech activists, volunteers, created open source software that allowed anyone to publish on the web. This was used at the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle in 1999. And as a result, I was able to talk to my conservative aunt in Louisville, Kentucky, and ask her, do you know what the World Trade Organization is? And she knew, because that word had gotten out. We had gotten through, kind of busted through the corporate media, you know, Great Wall of China that kept us all out. And we saw the power of what we could do. So a number of us were in the streets in Seattle, and we came home and said, you know what, our local newspaper, although it isn't part of the megalopoly, is conservative, and they do censor stories, especially about criminal justice issues, and they don't have any minority reporters. And our little independent paper just went belly up. And on WEFT, which I love, but there was really no space to get a show on WEFT except, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And we said, you know, we want to create a space where that's going to live for the decades that we need to live to really tackle this issue of media reform. And we started from the very beginning. 12 of us met in my living room. We collectivized our equipment, and we challenged the community and said, hey, you know, community, we want to start a community media center that's going to feed and be a way to train and a venue for groups that are marginalized to get the word out about the things that they care about and to have these kind of deep community discussions. So we challenged the community to fund it, and they did. We opened up a place in the little print shop on Main Street, and eventually we were able to purchase, with a capital campaign, all small donations, no sugar daddies, no big foundations. We bought the post office building in downtown Urbana and have been converting that into a community media and arts center from 2005 to present. So our vision you know, has changed over time because there are now blogs and people can easily publish on the web. And one of the things that we really see in terms of the future is to create, is to really be an organizing space where the power of media comes together with the power of organizing. We're part of a network called the Media Action Grassroots Network. It's a group of 100 organizations across the U.S., and it's really a local-to-local model where groups like, we work with Media Mobilizing Project in Philadelphia. They're on the network, similar to ourselves. In fact, we fiscally sponsor them to get off the ground. And they work with taxi cab drivers to produce media about the issues that they care about. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the big issue is, are we going to expand our jail? The county board's talking about spending $22 million of our tax dollars to build a jail when our current jails aren't full. And so we talk with people who have been in the jail system, family members who have dealt with the jails, and people who generally feel marginalized in the community. They use our venue to talk about these issues, to advocate and organize for change.
And now, Danielle Chenoweth, I mean, the Indy Media Center, since it's moved to the post office, I mean, it's really an umbrella of all sorts of activities that are going on there, isn't it?
Correct. So we have the radio station, our low power station, and the website, which was one kind of the original concept of Indy Media. But we also have a Books to Prisoners program that shipped over 60,000 books to inmates for free based on their requests. We opened two free jail libraries in the local county jail when there were none. We have a bike project. We've recycled thousands of bikes back into the community. And we have a makerspace. Our makerspace does everything with, they have a community wireless initiative where they are looking to develop the latest and greatest community wireless open source software to help to connect communities off the grid as well as connected to the World Wide Web. And they also do robotics. They teach robotics classes to kids. We have a radical librarians and anarchist archivists, and they have zine workshops. And we have a children's art festival. I mean, there's just the IMC here locally, what we wanted is to really be fertile ground for people to plant their ideas. And so there's not a lot of places you can go with a good idea and just plant it in the ground and see if it grows, because there's, staff and programs and everything's kind of established already. And so we wanted to be a place where we're mostly volunteer driven. We have over 1,200 volunteers, and we only have 1.5 full-time equivalent staff and 8 AmeriCorps members who support our programs. So it's mostly volunteer power, and we really kind of are open to people coming in and presenting ideas to us.
Where do the funds come to keep something this extensive in the heart of downtown Urbana going? It must be a significant budget you have.
So our budget is about $450,000 a year. A good chunk of that is the AmeriCorps program that comes from the state, and then we distribute to members. So it's kind of a pass-through employment situation. But we also have really, from the beginning, wanted to have a sustainable financial model. So we do have memberships and local donors. And, we have people who give $5 a month every month and have been doing that for 10 years. And those are really our stalwarts. And we do rent affordable office and subsidized art studio space to artists. And so we're able, that income is there. And then we have an events venue, which is, for members, $30 an hour, which is the cheapest you're going to find in town. And we have a venue that can hold hundreds of people. And, we have so many activities making use of that kind of subsidized space that income is able to support us. We have a couple of grants from the city of Urbana, supports our arts programming, and the state of Illinois Arts Council also supports us. And so we appreciate that support.
Our guest, Danielle Chenoweth, I'm out here on Media Matters with me, Bob McChesney, today. This is a pre-recorded show. Sit back, relax, enjoy it, but don't try to call in. Danielle Chenoweth, among other things, is one of the organizers of the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, which will be taking place here in the area at the end of July, the last weekend of the month, if I'm not mistaken. And you can go to grassrootsradioconference.org and find out everything you need to know about the conference. And I think if you do participate, you will be delighted to do so. Danielle Chenoweth, you work more than anyone I know, on, or as much as anyone I know, on local media, local community media. It's obvious you have a great passion and knowledge for it. At the same time, though, you know, you've been involved in winning the major fight that makes local community radio stations possible, the Local Community Radio Act that passed less than a year ago. What if you could look at Washington now, and if you had one question or two questions you could ask presidential candidates Obama and Romney on issues that you want them to address about media, what would they be?
First question is, do you support a free and open internet, and will you support it forever, no matter who comes to, what corporation comes to put money in your pocket? That's really my first question.
Is that a rhetorical question, Danielle Chenoweth?
And if you don't, then I don't know what you're worth, really, because it's so important and vital that we have that space open. So that's really, you know, the number one policy issue. And then in terms of other issues I would ask of presidential candidates, I mean, I like to think big picture. And I really, you know, this country has supported community media in the past, and it supported public media. And that support has really dwindled and become politicized. And I feel like, you know, there, if we look at other models like the UK or other other countries that really do it much better, Argentina is a great model, actually, then, you know, I feel like you can really see what is possible when it comes to public support of media, and a structure by which that support is depoliticized as much as possible. And I don't think it should just be public media. I'm a great supporter of WILL. I listen to WILL all the time. But I also think that those funds and that support really needs to come to support community media, and it needs to support public broadband. And so I would like, you know, when Obama first came into office, he did a couple of really great things. First, he did a great job opportunities for youth, and that was just a great way to infuse the economy. But he also did a broadband plan, and he helped to really instigate a public broadband initiative. And here in Champaign-Urbana, we're building a public broadband system that is going to give fat gigabyte level broadband service first to the poorest people in our community, and then eventually our goal is to build out to the whole community. And so I want to know what, you know, how our presidential candidates can support those initiatives. And honestly, I don't think that they can without finance, campaign finance reform. And we've only gone backwards on that issue, not forwards.
Now, you just mentioned this building a broadband system in Champaign-Urbana. A number of other communities are doing it in the United States, especially rural communities where the big companies don't really want to go in there and develop the service. What is the status of that in Champaign-Urbana? And a little more detail on that, if you would. And how much does it cost if you want to hook up to this network?
Yeah, so there have actually been many of us working for a decade to try to expand access to the internet and kind of do digital inclusion initiatives. And I think one of the reasons why our community was so successful in winning that grant, which was submitted by both cities and the university in close collaboration with the community, is because we had such a long-standing tradition of working together and building community collaboration. And so we want $22.5 million. Some of that is matched with local money, and the fiber is going in the ground. So for those of you who are local, those big orange tubes that are sticking up in the corners of various parts of Champaign-Urbana, that's fat broadband that is coming either to low-income homes, or there's also a fiber ring that connects a lot of different anchor institutions, including Urbana IMC, to this network. And when that happens and when we're able to build out to the whole community, and this community is considering applying for a grant next month through GigU that would actually help to build out to the whole community, you know, all kinds of things become possible. On the price issue, it's looking like it's really going to be in the $20 to $30 a month for, we're talking faster than you can imagine broadband, where it's complete, you know, you can do total video conferencing, et cetera. You can do file sharing. Communities, we could have a community archive, kind of like we have a library that's physically present. We can also have an online library, and people could put things there. They can produce videos that are hours long that download instantly, and people can watch them and share them.
Wouldn't it be great for the community, Daniel Chenoweth, if we could just have a network that was available for free to everyone in the county, for example. Mm-hmm. And then so all businesses, all individuals automatically get it for free. And then it would be run as a nonprofit service with a budget, and it would be supported by the government primarily. But I would imagine the cost would plummet if you didn't have to worry about billing and setting up secret codes and putting up barbed wire. And said, here it is. Everyone can have the best broadband in the world. And wouldn't that be great for the economy, too?
Yes. I think broadband should be free, and I think that there's a lot of really good reasons to make it free. For the purposes of this grant, we were able to make the finances work with this small fee that households would pay per month, although I do think that fee is a barrier for low-income households and could be a barrier. And I think, let's put it this way. I got two trash haulers that come by my house once a week. One picks up my trash, and I have to buy it on the open market, and it's $15 a month. One picks up my recycling. Same thing, same truck, practically the same people. I pay $3 a month through my taxes for that. And it's the same thing with so many other things. If you actually look, if you are able to collectivize and do something through a public means, you pay a fraction of the cost. And so I see no reason, a visionary local government would really look to see how to make broadband ubiquitous. Everyone has access. It's like air that we breathe. You can have access to it. And I think that if we're able to, once we build out to all the different parts of the community, we can look at some financial models to do that. And maybe it is the case that the businesses and the organizations help subsidize the residential, or maybe we're able to see like, okay, I don't pay when I walk into the library. Why should I pay when I connect to broadband? It could be a public good that's free for everyone.
I mean, actually, probably better wouldn't just make it nationally free. So anywhere in the country, you don't have to know a secret code or pay someone off or have to pay $40 a month to a mobile carrier to get crummy service.
Now, Bob, the stocks for Comcast just plummeted when you said that. So you have to be very careful with what you say on the air.
Our guest, Daniel Chenoweth. I'm Bob McChesney. We're wrapping up today's show. We've got about 10 minutes to go on Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show. Please don't call in. Let us do the talking. Back at you live next week on July 8th. Danielle, we've got, as I said, around 10 minutes to go. And a couple things I really want to talk about. First of all, and this gets a little bit off the subject, but, in this sort of changing media environment where traditional newspapers are collapsing, traditional journalism is really sort of in disarray, someone like you who is a political junkie, who really follows, cares about the community, cares about the world, where do you get your information now? What do you consider a diet you need to have to know what's going on locally and nationally and internationally?
Well, it's interesting. I might be kind of eclectic because the first thing that I do every day is I read the local newspaper, and I read it religiously, and I archive it. And if I'm as a local organizer, it's important for me to actually track stories very carefully over like a 3 to 5 year horizon. So I've been following this jail expansion issue for almost 10 years, and I actually have an archive. We're talking physical archive with a folder of news stories that I've clipped. And I also, if WILL airs something, I'll actually download that and keep it as a virtual file. So I still believe in local newspapers. You lay out on the table, you got your baby on your lap, and you're drinking your coffee, and you read the newspaper, and you know what is happening. I would back up. The very first thing that happens is that the alarm goes off and I listen to either WILL or WEFT. And it's usually the morning news with WILL. So I'm able to kind of know what's going on. I'm very locally focused in that way. And then I have a neighbor who kicks me the New York Times. I don't actually pay for it. And she gives me after she's done reading it, she gives it to me. And then I read it and our whole household reads it. And you should see our house is full of newspapers. But, after that, I also, I'm on certain listservs or I I subscribe to certain news feeds. I actually get Media Matters. It's my podcast. It's on my iPhone. And so I will listen to and consume some of these other pieces. But I'm really focused on, for media policy, you know, I really look at what the Benton Foundation puts out, kind of report every day. It's like, what is the latest in media? And it's got a lot of what I need. And then I'm part of coalitions on media reform. And that's, there's regular things that come out of the Media Action, Media and Democracy Coalition, and the Media Action Grassroots Network. So I'm getting regular news from those pieces. So that's, I don't spend a huge amount of time consuming news because I do want to talk to humans and take care of my baby and cook dinner. But I do, you know, I really do start with the local, and then I do specific news feeds on listservs and things like that.
If you want to know about some prospective war going on around the world, what media would you use?
Well, I oftentimes go to like Common Cause or Truth Out if I'm looking for more kind of analytical stuff. I tend to not want to be one of those people who just wants to know the latest bloody thing. I actually feel like there's so many amazing organizing efforts happening in the world, and those are not being reported on, but all the death and destruction is. And so although I kind of know what's going on with the death and destruction, I actually don't find that news. I find that olds. That's olds. That's violence. And I really want to know what is going on. You know, what is Unite Here doing to organize hospitality workers? And what, you know, Coalition of Immokalee Farm Workers just won a huge victory, penny for a pound for its tomato workers. I want to know how they did that. And I want news I can use to both transform my local community and news I can use to organize on a national level. And that other kind of stuff, I actually don't think it's news, and I don't really feel it's worth its weight in ink.
How do you think Champaign-Urbana has changed in the 17 years you've been here?
Well, I think that through organizing efforts, we've been able to really capture a lot of the local government and municipalities and kind of move things to the progressive left. So this town used to be run a lot by bankers and lawyers, and now it's run by more academics and tech people and progressives, although we shouldn't stop there because I feel that the biggest challenge our community faces is a racial divide, and the fact that almost you can, and I work in this community, and I'm speaking from experience, it is very difficult to find an African-American male in Champaign-Urbana who does not have a felony conviction, and sometimes it's for the stupidest thing you ever thought, like giving out a false name. And there was really a systematic attempt to disenfranchise and to mark African-American males with felonies. And that tradition continues to this day. And so I think the biggest challenge Champaign-Urbana faces is now that there's a lot of more white progressive liberal types running the cities in Champaign and Urbana, that we really got to take the next step to figure out how to be a much more inclusive university and inclusive community.
Yeah, indeed. That's absolutely the case. One of the other things, the last thing I really wanted to ask you about, Danielle Chenoweth, is, and I think you might have mentioned this earlier, the Media Action Grassroots Network, MAGNET, that you're involved with. But this is a national group, right?
Yeah, so the Media Action Grassroots Network is a group of about over 100 groups, and the Urbana IMC is an anchor group for downstate Illinois. And it's really a local-to-local advocacy network of grassroots-based community organizations that really combine the media with the social justice piece. And so media is a transforming tool for them to end poverty, to address racism, to, you know, work on human rights issues. And right now that group has a couple of campaigns going that I think are noteworthy. About 10 years ago, actually about 8 years ago, Urbana IMC members used our IMC to advocate for the end of a phone contract on the county level that gouged inmates and their families. Every time they would call, they would pay huge fees to be able to call in and out of the jail. And this is for people, many of whom are innocent, awaiting trial and don't have the money to make bail. And so
even if you're guilty, you shouldn't be gouged.
Exactly. So we really worked to end that practice, and the IMC was really instrumental in getting the word out and kind of advocating on that. And so now we're seeing that there is a national campaign that Magnet is heading up to work with the FCC to prohibit that gouging of prisoner families with those phone contracts. The second one has to do with internet freedom and really supporting a free and open internet, and in particular also supporting kind of open hardware, open software with cell phone and other devices. And there's Latinos for Internet Freedom and African Americans for Internet Freedom, really working with communities of color who oftentimes use the cell phone as their way of accessing the internet. And for those of you media junkies, you know that in some ways the compromise that seems to be forming is, hey, if you have broadband in the home, you can have free and open internet. But if you're accessing content on your cell phone, there's a lot of people under the current administration who are fine with basically content being censored or restricted for you. So, and then the third campaign has to do with expanding community media, and Magnet is supporting the expansion of low-power FM across the country.
Danielle Chenoweth, with one last question. Facebook, what do you think of it?
You know, it's scary and it's great. It's scary because when I say that I like something, that can actually be used as an ad to sell things. And we know that, and we've seen that happen. And there's a lot of, Facebook is insecure. If people want to know my entire network and who I'm connected to, there is always and forever the threat of fascism. And there's really always that effort to control and to continue to control. And I think Facebook kind of maps social networks in a way that makes it easy for there to be government control and surveillance. On the other hand, I love Facebook because I'm able to post a question to my friends and get an immediate set of answers. I'm able to share photos of my baby. I'm able to connect with, boyfriends from sixth grade. All kinds of wacky things can happen on Facebook. And I do think that it is a significant organizing tool for communities. Of course, we've seen that outside of the United States and here. I actually, in one of my many lives, I do media training both in Thailand and Burma. And so in those environments, Facebook has been really important for people to connect with each other. But of course, it's an insecure space for them to do so as well.
Danielle Chenoweth, if people want to learn more about the Independent Media Center here in Urbana-Champaign, what website should they go to?
Well, you can go to ucimc.org. You can also come visit us in the downtown post office in downtown Urbana. And right now we do have a number of spaces for folks to get on the air at WRFU. And if you come to the Grassroots Radio Conference, which early birds registration ends in 2 days on June 10th, it's very cheap, and if you volunteer, you actually get a discount. So you can come to the Grassroots Radio Conference for $50 or $75 if you want. And you'll learn everything you need to know to get on air.
Well, that's great to hear. Danielle Chenoweth, I should say, listeners, we recorded this June 8th. That's the reference. You're too late for the early bird, I'm afraid, but I'm sure you can still get connected. Danielle Chenoweth, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us here at Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's show and Christina Williams for her work as producer. I'll be back 1 week from today. Everyone, have a great summer. Bye-bye.